Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya, on the lands of Kanamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show,
I think any community that has barriers to healthcare benefits when we can take some of those barriers down. So whether that be our Indigenous communities, our LGBTQIA plus communities, you know, our communities who suffer from homelessness.
Australia's healthcare system is set for a change as some qualified registered nurses will now be able to prescribe certain medications aimed to ease strain. But doctors have raised concerns. Also, today marks 50 years since five Western journalists were killed by Indonesian troops in East Timor, and a new book explores what happened at that moment. And later...
And that's what's really exciting, is that having this chance to be able to make work for a major exhibition, people are really pushing their ideas and the audience gets to see that Aboriginal art is whatever the artist wants to use to be able to express themselves.
Tanandi Art Fair returns for its 10th year, celebrating First Nations culture and stories through art in the state and beyond. What exactly is signified by this year's milestone? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, over 2,000 public sector workers walked off the job yesterday to convene on the steps of SA's Parliament, calling on government to boost pay rates by 20% over 3 years. The staff, represented by one of the state's peak unions, the Public Service Association, say they are outraged at working below the poverty line as the cost of living crisis deepens. I spoke with Catherine Mayle, PSA delegate and plebotomist, to hear more.
The reason why we stand together with all the rest of the PSA union members is because it needs time for change, because we're underpaid and the government's not recognising public sector workers for their worth. And it's becoming a struggle with the lack of wage increases.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you like about your job and the role that you play in our healthcare system?
I love my job role. I love servicing the patients on the RA wards to take their bloods, as it's crucial. The doctors need the phlebotomists to take bloods from patients on the ward for them to diagnose patients for treatments, medications, etc. I enjoy the interaction with the patients, so I wouldn't have any other job. And being a supervisor, I actually train new staff into the position, and so I enjoy training new staff to make them qualified as a phlebotomist. It's great to see people succeed and train, but the thing is, keeping them here in the company is a struggle to do with the low income.
And what is it that you want from our government? What do you want them to hear?
I want them to do a fair deal with giving us a pay rise and appreciating what us as workers do for the public sector. We're here to serve the public sector. I'm just tired of the government just saying, oh, we don't deserve a pay rise. The government gets pay rises, but no one questions that, do we? It's pretty disgraceful. It's like we're all the public sector workers aren't valued through the government eyes, yet we work for the government.
Yesterday, we had thousands of people attend Parliament House to call on the Premier to urgently lift public sector wages. So that involved members walking off the job, essentially. So some prisons locked down, others had a reduction in services to attend. We had a really diverse group of workers there. We had child protection workers who look after children in a community from Department of Child Protection. We had CFS, SES, sheriff's officers, seasonal firefighters, correctional officers who work in our prisons, youth justice, lawyers, specialists, pathology workers, housing officers, you know, who take calls from people in the community escaping domestic violence and homelessness and get them into safe housing. All of those workers were there yesterday, which was amazing. These are the people that get us through the toughest times, like COVID. So all of these vital services that are provided to the South Australian community turned out in force yesterday.
That's newly elected PSA General Secretary Charlotte Watson, a representative of the public sector workers. She points to the major impacts experienced by workers and the sector as wages stagnate below the poverty line.
It is having a significant impact on attraction and retention in the South Australian public sector. We are really struggling to attract people and to keep them. It's not uncommon for people to come and be gone again within 3 months. It's also resulting in vacancies sitting in the sector when they shouldn't be, which is creating safety impacts for these members. So we are seeing an increase in assaults and safety incidents in our sector. And of course, it's also having a psychological impact on our members, which is really significant as well.
Public service workers have received annual pay rises equivalent to 1% a year, increasing by just 6% over 6 years, while other workers have seen a minimum increase of 3.5% annually. So after 6 years, most workers typically would see their pay rise by 21%. Not six. Meanwhile, we're in a cost of living crisis. Inflation rates have risen by as high as just over 7%. What impact does this have on day-to-day living and potentially the capacity for employees to even stay in this situation?
We have members that have second jobs just to make ends meet. One of our members last week rang me in tears because she doesn't know how long she can go on like this. She's got a second job at Subway and she thinks that she can get a better salary at Subway if she was to leave and to go work there, which is just terrifying. We know of members in regional locations who are walking or riding like 12 kilometres to work because they can't afford to register their cars. It is getting to a really, really critical point for our members.
And I'm aware that during negotiations for a 3-year enterprise agreement with the state government, they offered 3.75% in the first year, 3.5% in the second year, and 3.25% for the final year. I'm also aware that these have stalled, but what's your response to this negotiation?
We've rejected that offer. We say that it does not come anywhere near close enough to catching up these workers. We have a claim for 20% over 18 months. It might at first sound like a large number, but when you have a look at the fact that they've received the equivalent of 1% a year over the last 6 years, and inflation's run as high as 7.2% during those years, these workers are sitting 20 to 30% behind now, which is why that is our claim for 20% over an 18-month agreement. I really think I just want to emphasise the importance for the Premier to step in urgently and lift these wages for these workers. They are great people. There's 40,000 South Australians covered by this enterprise agreement. So it's 40,000 South Australians and their families depending on the Premier to step in and urgently lift these wages.
Newly elected PSA General Secretary Charlotte Watson speaking with me. The Wire has also contacted state government for further comment.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
As of September 2025, qualified registered nurses will be allowed to prescribe certain medications after undertaking a 6-month course and clinical mentorship following 3 years' experience. This change comes in an effort to help relieve stress on hospitals, which struggled to recover after COVID-19, and offers faster access to care with shorter wait times. But some believe this reform will be too much responsibility for nurses who have been green-lighted to prescribe Schedule 8 drugs such as fentanyl. The Wire's Ella Panizzolo reports.
As wait times for medical care expand, a new solution is being put into play. With registered nurses in other countries such as the UK and Canada already permitted to prescribe medication, Australia has decided to join them. Corrine Dunningham, nurse practitioner and university lecturer at La Trobe University, believes this is a monumental moment for Australia's medical field.
Probably one of the biggest changes in the nursing profession from a scope of practice perspective in quite a long time. And what it means is that for patients, they have access to nurses who are able to provide prescriptions under certain circumstances to them. And it helps with like decreasing delays in care. So it will allow those nurses to be able to provide prescriptions for, say, a GP patient who's on a very stable blood pressure medication they don't need to wait to see the GP to see that. They could book in with the nurse and the nurse could do their blood pressure checks and do their repeat prescription in that sort of circumstance. So that's one of the examples of where this may work really, really well.
Speaking on behalf of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Associate Professor and Rural Chair for the College, Dr. Michael Clements suggests that the model of care around RNs prescribing medication must be supported to ensure patient safety.
Well, when this is exercised and operated in a good model of care, with good collaboration and communication between different team members, it's going to be great for care. We have good examples of registered nurses already being able to dispense medications under their own authority in places like the Northern Territory under the remote area nurse model. And this is very similar to the nurse practitioner-like model, where nurses that have undertaken additional training and supervision and been assessed have been found to provide great extra benefits for communities where they might be more available.
A report by the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine found that around 30% of patients awaiting hospital admissions were experiencing delays of up to 8 hours since arriving. There are a range of reasons as to why hospital waits are so long, including understaffed facilities and lack of beds.
Do you think this reform will help reduce wait times and pressures on hospitals and GPs?
That is the hope. I'd love to have a crystal ball and know that these things are going to be happening, but definitely that is the aim of this change in legislation and of upskilling our nurses into the prescribing area, is it does help support our autonomous prescribers, doctors, nurse practitioners, and allows them to be able to focus some of their time on that they would have spent on some routine prescriptions or certain circumstances with prescribing, that they can then focus on other aspects of care and allow some of that shared responsibility with care.
We know that hospitals are good environments for collaborative care. We know that nurses or nurse practitioners or pharmacists that engage with prescribing and treating disease and diagnosing disease in a teamwork environment like a hospital is a good environment for these kinds of models of care to work, and a very safe one, and are good for communities, and will certainly benefit communities where that's undertaken.
With extra hands on deck prescribing medications, it could reduce strain and make healthcare more accessible for people in subcultures and communities that often avoid traditional medical settings. Groups such as LGBTQIA+ people, First Nations communities, and those experiencing destitution often face stigma and longer wait times when seeking treatment. RN's prescribing could help in bridging those gaps, offering faster, culturally sensitive care in community clinics and regional areas.
I think any community that has barriers to healthcare benefits when we can take some of those barriers down. So whether that be our Indigenous communities, our LGBTQIA+ communities, our communities who suffer from homelessness or lower socioeconomic who don't have access to funds to be able to pay for these.
The Wire's Ella Panizzolo ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Today marks 50 years since 5 Western journalists were killed by Indonesian troops in East Timor. And a new book explores what happened at that moment. Author Susan Francis wrote Revelation Beach to expose one of Australia's most shameful cover-ups, where the Australian government was allegedly complicit. The legal battle was shrouded in secrecy thanks to the then Attorney General, Christian Porter, invoking the National Security Information Act. The Wire's Nikki Page spoke with Susan Francis to find out more.
So in 1974, there was a revolution in Portugal. And after the revolution, many of those colonies were released. One of those places was East Timor. It left fertile ground for who was going to come in and govern the country. The Indonesians decided that they were going to occupy East Timor and make it their own country. So it's a very, very crucial little country in terms of Australia. Australia was aware then that Indonesia was about to invade East Timor, and Channel 7 and Channel 9 and the ABC dispatched reporters to report on what was happening. There were five journalists moved up from the capital, Dili, to the border town of Balabo. On the 16th of October 1975, Indonesian troops made an early incursion into Balabo, and the five journalists, they were executed brutally. The Australian government knew almost on the same day what happened, but the truth was kept secret.
Your book, Revelation Beach, the scenes set in Indonesia and Dili do seem very credible. Briefly tell us about your own experience in either or both of those places.
So Indonesia, I went to a town called Surabaya. That was in 1980. Far away from friends and family, you know, there were no mobile phones, there were no computers. Mail took 3 months. So a very isolating experience. And I could never understand when I was wandering around Indonesia or meeting people, or a sense of real tension and that I wasn't welcome. When I was evacuated out of the country because there were demonstrations, riots on the streets. When I returned home, I put it into historical perspective. 5 years earlier, the journalists had been killed. 15 years earlier, the president had killed hundreds and thousands of East Javanese people accused of being communists or academics. I saw black squares in the newspaper that the government censors had decided they didn't want people to read about. I was told not to talk about anything to do with the government. I have a diary that I wrote in. Those scenes are drawn from my personal experience. East Timor, that research came out of the files of Jill Jolliffe, who was an ABC journalist. And what grounded Timor in authenticity was what Jill had seen, and Jill Jolliffe's lifelong commitment to trying to reveal the truth about what had happened to the journalists.
Your book is set in 2000 and in the preceding 25 years. Why did you choose that era?
So in 1999, the UN moved into East Timor because the new president, after Suharto, had decided that East Timor would be given their freedom. I didn't particularly choose it because of that. I chose it because I had to make my protagonist Eleanor. You know, she had to be a certain age in 1975. So it was more a book thing and making that work, but it was a very important year for East Timor.
Reflecting now and bearing in mind Bernard Kaleri, Witness K, Shirley Shackleton, who fought so hard to get the truth, what would you like to share with less informed listeners?
When Indonesia occupied East Timor in 1975, for the next 25 years, the Australian government kept quiet for two reasons. Number one, they thought it was better to negotiate about that oil and gas with the Indonesians than negotiate with the East Timorese. Number two, when Indonesia invaded East Timor, we were the only country in the entire world that recognised Indonesia's right to occupy East Timor.
Author Susan Francis speaking with The Wire's Nikki Page. Adelaide is celebrating the 10th year of Tanundi, South Australia's Festival of Contemporary Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art. The anniversary marks a decade showcasing First Nations voices through photography, painting, ceramics, moving image, jewellery and more. With several works for sale, profits are returned to the artists and their community-run centres. During the past decade, at least 9,000 First Nations artists have exhibited works, with the festival offering a vital platform for artists across the state and beyond. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with Tanundi Artistic Director Nikki Cumpston to talk more about what this milestone represents.
Oh, gosh, it's such a big, big moment to be able to, you know, see all of the work that people have done over the years. You know, people come from all over the world to see Tanundi and from all over the country. And so it's been a really great platform for people to be able to share their stories, to have, you know, their stories recorded in a catalogue through the festival program for those partner exhibitions that we have across the city and state, and for them to be able to come together in Adelaide to meet each other, and to get to know each other and to hear each other's stories. And I think that has been a really big part of Tarnadi, has been the empowerment that people feel from having that experience together and being able to share that.
How could this exhibition help broader Australians to understand First Nations stories in an alternate medium?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about Tarnadi, is that the artists are working right across mediums, from photography to moving image to sculpture, you know, paintings, of course. But then you also have people working in ceramics, every different medium, because, of course, as Aboriginal people, we all come from very diverse cultures and backgrounds. We're not just one homogenous culture. And that's what's really exciting, is that having this chance to be able to make work for a major exhibition, people are really pushing their ideas, and the audience gets to see that Aboriginal art is whatever the artist wants to use to be able to express themselves.
Tarnadi is showcasing in both metro and regional galleries across the state. Is there any differences in these exhibitions, and does the nature of the art differ from previous years?
So we have regional Tarnadi, which is currently showing in Port Augusta, Woven Within Stars, and that exhibition has been curated by our regional curator, Marika Davies. We started that opportunity a couple of years ago because we could see that regional artists don't get the same opportunities as artists in the city. And the artists in this year's exhibition are elder people and younger people. So it's a real mix of artists from, you know, many different stages in their careers. And the works of art are very diverse in each of the exhibitions that you will see across the whole city and the state.
Whilst providing both opportunities for First Nations artists and for the wider community to see this growth, how can art uphold or preserve First Nations culture and history?
Oh, art is, you know, a way for people to have a voice. It's a platform for people to be able to share their ideals. It's for them to be able to share whether they're contemporary stories or traditional stories of their ancestral knowledge. It's such an important platform because it's the only way that people have to be able to express themselves and to be able to share what their beliefs are, what their ideas are, and what, you know, what they're really aspiring to in life. So art is absolutely essential for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to be on a stage, to have that opportunity to really to share whatever it is that they want to share with us. Some people share really deep stories. Other people are creating work that's, you know, that's telling different stories. It's not all about the same thing. And I think that's what is so important for people to understand, is that every artist is unique, just like any artist in the world.
What role can community play in preserving artistic and cultural sovereignty?
Culture is happening every day. People are practicing culture. And it's just that by providing these chances for people to have an exhibition gives them a way to work towards an end goal and to be able to actually, you know, create a body of work. But that's not to say that cultural work is not still being done in community. So I think that's a really important point, is that people need support to be able to be themselves, to be able to share their stories and to be able to be together, to collectively, you know, enhance what they're doing culturally. But these opportunities to exhibit and to be part of an artistic community really helps to develop and build people's confidence, you know, build their strength and belief in what they're doing so that they can continue to make that work for a larger audience. And for the broader population to be able to understand the depths of understanding and knowledge that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have for country and for kin.
Tarnadi Artistic Director Nikki Cumston speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show, brought to you from Mamina Shakur at 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.